Welcome to the MRI Cast. These podcasts focus on various current topics in MRI. We invite you to ask questions via the website and even suggest topics for future MRI casts. The opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect standards in clinical practices, nor should they be considered as medical advice. Well, hello everyone. I'm Bill Faulkner and welcome to the MRI Cast. We're going to be doing a series of seven MRI casts on the topic of gadolinium-based contrast agents, peeling back the gadolinium-based contrast agents, if you will, and taking a deeper look. This series is sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics, and we certainly appreciate their support. This MRI cast is part one of a two-part podcast looking at the use of gadolinium-based contrast agents in adult and pediatric neuroimaging. With this part, we're going to start with the pediatric components. And with me today are two people that have a lot of experience in pediatric MR imaging. Kristen Harrington. Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Bill. Thanks. How are you?
Oh, just dandy. And the ever popular Dr. Howard Raleigh. How are you, Howard?
Doing great, Bill. It's a beautiful day in Madison, Wisconsin, as always.
Oh, that's great. All snowy, is it?
It's gorgeous.
That's great. All right. Well, let's get started. Let's just jump right into this. And we'll start with Howard. When you think about neuroimaging in peds, particularly the use of gadolinium-based contrast agents, what's kind of some of the first things that comes to your mind as the radiologist in charge of this exam?
Well, for starters, like any other exam, you want to make sure you're doing the right exam for the right patient and at the right time, I guess. And sometimes those exams will require gadolinium. Other times they won't. And we have a whole range of protocols, as I'm sure all of our listeners do. And in particular, we at Madison have developed a number of really fast protocols, which in some cases don't require gadolinium. For example, our quick brain protocols for hydrocephalus, and now some fast brain protocols for stroke. So we always view wading into each individual case as a customized case. We want to get it right the first time.
You mentioned a couple of them there, hydrocephalus and the stroke imaging protocol.
Stroke.
What others come to mind real quick that may not require gadolinium, or often don't, maybe?
Well, for sure, just a ventricle check doesn't require gadolinium unless you encounter something unexpected. So that'd be a non-contrast quick brain exam, single shot fast spin echo or haste type sequence. We also do a lot of non-contrast studies for routine follow-ups of, patients with epilepsy sometimes don't need gadolinium. They need instead maybe higher res cortical imaging protocols and spine imaging for at least, scoliosis or degenerative conditions, which can occur in kids, may not require contrast. But a lot of the contrast exams are just exactly what you'd expect from the adult world as well, infection, tumor follow-up. Those will usually require gadolinium.
Kristen, what about your experience with that?
Well, definitely we don't use contrast for TS patients, tuberosclerosis, I think is how you pronounce it. What do you guys do, Howard, as far as TS patients?
Well, tuberosclerosis has a range of abnormalities, cortical tubers. They get sometimes subependymal giant cell tumors, which are the ones down along the foramina Monroe. There is actually a reasonable indication to follow up, give gadolinium, because sometimes those SEGAs, the subependymal giant cell tumors, they're astrocytomas, and they can transform over time. You could argue to check to see if it's getting bigger before you give contrast, but sometimes if they're planned for sedation, for example, we just plan to give contrast so that we can find out if their SEGA has transformed into a higher grade tumor.
So you would just do it without contrast, and then someone would call you and you would review the images and make the determination at that time?
Yeah, it all depends. To be honest, we do check every sedated or anesthetized kid before we give contrast and after we give contrast, make sure we got it. But for a TS follow-up, we would typically prescribe it and protocol it as a with contrast exam. I know that a lot of places would just go non-con and check, and I think that could be appropriate as well. We want to have the definitive information, and even if the sega hasn't enlarged, sometimes it will start to enhance, and that tells us it's biologically transforming into something we need to worry about.
Just another question. As far as pituitaries go, you know, how do you handle cella or pituitary requests?
So in almost all cases, those are going to require contrast because, of course, the pituitary doesn't have a blood-brain barrier and it enhances quite rapidly. And for the microadenomas, which are very common, we'll want to see that as a filling defect, a non-enhancing defect that then may fill in later. So for pituitaries, we'll typically include contrast. And that would also be true to help characterize other cellular masses like craniopharyngiomas, for example, to make sure that a benign looking pituitary cyst really is benign and not something else, germinoma, other things that can occur in the cella.
And diffusion would be useful in those types of patients as well, I'm assuming.
Well, usually we get diffusion in everyone. If we're really wanting to characterize, say, a cellular tumor that may or may not be invading the clivus or the cavernous sinus, we'll specifically protocol a blade or propeller type diffusion, which of course is more of a fast spin echo or turbo spin echo type backbone. So you don't get all the susceptibility and signal pileup artifacts inherent in a standard, echo planar diffusion sequence.
I think that's really helpful information because I was recently approached by a facility that said they had changed their protocol, and whether it was requested by the physician or not, to be with and without, that they were to do all of them without and, have them checked. But sometimes a radiologist was not available. So they were then sending the patients away. So they were all, it was a standard, which, we all can't stand these blanket, protocols that they were to do them no longer with contrast at all, unless they decided to.
Sometimes building the system is really important. I think it was W. Edwards Deming said something like a bad system will beat a good person every time, And so you want to have kind of, we have an approach that we want our protocols to be pretty bulletproof, and we don't like bring backs, especially in kids who might be sedated. And so we try to answer the question the first time. And it's one reason we also, it will come to this later probably, we also get 3D imaging in every single patient except for our quick studies, so that we can scan once and recon many and sort things out even after they're gone, even if we might have missed something on the initial review.
And I think that's really important for people to hear that. So yes, get it done, one and done. That's what we prefer to do, at least at my facility. So I completely, especially for the sedated patients, whether it's deep sedation or it's a general anesthesia.
I also really prefer to have our technologists know what they're going to do and just go from one scan to the next and not have to wait for somebody like me to get around to calling them back, or they're busy doing a procedure. And, you just don't want to hang up the workflow. It's a lot better to make the decision when you protocol it. Do they need contrast or not? And do your best to just make that call. And if in doubt, we tend to give contrast if there's a reason in the indication, and we'll just set it up that way.
I think a lot of, going back to the comment about the system, I think a lot of times I hear people say, well, we have issues with this, we have issues with that, relative to workflow. And it seems to me like a lot of people, instead of designing their system to benefit the patient, they design the system to benefit them. And that's really just, not good patient practice. So I'm glad that was brought up. I think that's something people need to consider. If you have trouble, getting stuff done, take a look at your system, see why it's not working, and don't just settle for some excuse like, well, that's the way we've always done it, or we just don't have enough people to do it any different, which, you know, it just means it's going to languish the way it's always been done.
One of the nice things, in quotes, about the pandemic and working from home and working in a distributed fashion is that we've found checking scans to be really actually quite a lot easier than when we're all sitting in the room, because we're all on, you know, a communication software program called Jabber, and we have multiple rooms we can be logged into. And our technologists from any of our, you know, two dozen magnets or sites can jabber and say, I need so-and-so's scan checked. And there's like, you know, 10 people watching that, and they get things checked very quickly and keep moving on. So that's been a really important advance, I think, that will be carried forward as one of the positive things coming out of learning how to work remotely.
Howard mentioned something about pulse sequence selection, and I really would want to address that. And then we'll just talk about, you know, GAD use in general, but which we sort of have, but I guess look a little closer at it. There are several approaches to this. One of the things that I've been impressed with, actually learned the hard way, is if you do any type of your first sequence after gadolinium really should have a bit of a delay in front of it. You shouldn't be just injecting gad and then do one and done. I mean, years ago, we used to do that. Now, thankfully, years ago, the sequence probably took 5 or 6 minutes to do back in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. But today, our stuff is so quick, we've got to be real careful about looking at that first series after gad. And I know, Howard, I've heard you speak to this as well, and I'd like you to kind of speak to that again about, you know, you can image too quickly, and then there are things you can do to, you know, make it more efficient, if you will.
Efficient and really optimize the visualization of enhancing lesions. And the time aspect of it is really important, especially for some sort of slowly enhancing lesions like MS plaques are a good example. But really for almost anything that's enhancing, and we're not talking about pituitary now, pituitary still needs to be quickly imaged and even dynamically imaged. But for most brain and spinal cord lesions, they need a little time for the gadolinium to percolate and cross that usually altered blood-brain barrier and collect in the lesion. And, you know, it helps to have the background lose its gadolinium because it's not retaining it. It's not abnormal. So something like a 4 to 8 minute delay, something on that order is really helpful. And what we've done for the last nearly 20 years is all of our brains, for example, we know we're going to get a T2 flare. So what we do is we just move that from the contrast position that most people put it in and move it to the post contrast position. And that does a couple things. It kills about 4 minutes or so, so that then when we go on to our other post contrast series, which is typically an MP Rage or a Bravo type gradient echo 3D volume, and followed by nowadays a T1 cube, a spin echo FATSAT image. Those last two are acquired at 4 to 10 minutes roughly after the injection. And those are our money gadolinium enhancement shots. We want them as volume so we can use them for treatment planning and neuronavigation, radiation planning, et cetera. And we want to be able to recon them after they leave. So our standard brain gets 3 post contrasts in this order, a sagittal T2 flare cube or space, an axial gradient echo T1, which is done with either a Bravo or MP Rage type sequence. And then finally, we end up with a coronal T1 FATSAT, which is nominally a spin echo. We usually use something from the cube family. So we've got 3 directly acquired planes, 3 volumes, takes less than 10 minutes if you use parallel and kind of monkey with the techniques a little bit, and you have essentially no bringbacks because you can recon any one of those in any plane or obliquity. It's a really good system, and it builds in that delay to every case.
One of the things about the T2 flare after gadolinium, to Howard's point, I want to make sure everybody understands this. It's not a pre and a post, right? It's just a post. You don't need to do the flare pre. because everything you'd see on it pre, you would see on the post, correct? I mean, there's no reason to do it.
That's right. So, for example, people start to get a little edgy when they think about this. They think, well, I use my T2 flare to exclude blood. You'll still see non-suppression of SALSI flare, fluid attenuated inversion recovery. You'll still see subarachnoid blood on a post-contrast flare. And in fact, you know, when you step back and look at it, when you see that non-suppression, it's blood, pus, or cells of some sort, whether it's pre- or post-contrast. It's just that you'll see it better if it's post-contrast, especially in the case of some, say, leptomeningeal metastases or inflammatory conditions like meningitis. So there's really very little downside and a lot of upside to getting that T2 flare post-contrast only. It makes it more efficient. You don't really need a pre and a post on that.
I know that it says for, you know, at least at my facility, that if we are giving contrast, then that always goes post-contrast and you do not do it pre-contrast. I want to circle back to the delay time and doing the T2 post or the T2 flare post-contrast. I had a, and Bill knows about this specific situation, I actually had someone that watched my children. She was from what is considered a third world country, and her father went in because he was having seizures and headaches. And he had only one scan done post-contrast. They did see a brain tumor, but they thought it to be slow growing. She got all the images sent to me. I obviously took it to one of our radiologists. And what happened was they biopsied it. It took him a long time to get him back and to be seen. And it turned out to be an anaplastic grade 3 oligodendroglioma, which means it's fast-growing and malignant. And I think that had they had that delay, and Howard, you can speak to this, had they had that delay for it to percolate, as you say, do you think that would have helped?
Well, I think it probably would have shown more contrast enhancement if they'd had the delay. But, you know, even some grade 3 tumors won't enhance or only enhance a little bit. The enhancement is actually an imperfect way to try to grade tumors. And it's why, for instance, in our tumor protocols, we usually prospectively get perfusion imaging. So that would actually be the first or during contrast injection sequence we would get. And things like blood volume or permeability can more closely predict tumor grades, either at diagnosis or during follow-up. So another aspect of this is for those who, you know, for instance, think, well, if I see a tumor, I'll get perfusion then, and maybe some sites are using arterial spin labeling perfusion. One downside of giving gadolinium is that you can't get ASL after you've given gadolinium because it requires on the T1 relaxation times. And if you shorten it with gadolinium, you basically can get no signal. So that's one downside. Although if you see a mass on your pre-contrast images, I think you get a richer, more complete data set with dynamic susceptibility, contrast, perfusion, CBV, CBF, transit times, et cetera, than you do with ASL, which is just a CBF measure. But if you're going to do ASL, you just have to remember you have to do that before contrast, and it's probably only going to work at 3 Tesla.
Now, if we're talking about perfusion, I just want your very strong opinion, because the facilities that I work with, as far as pediatrics, they do not do perfusion with new brain tumors. And I find that to be a tragedy because they're giving contrast already. It's not part of their protocol.
Well, we differ because we do make that part of our protocol. We use ASL in kids for epilepsy in some cases, but for any other perfusion indication, we use dynamic susceptibility gadolinium enhanced contrast because, as you pointed out, you're giving the contrast anyway. So all you do is run a sequence that runs about a minute, minute and a half. You capture that wash in and wash out, run it through software, and you've got your perfusion metrics. And it's not just for diagnosis. You know, maybe there's one part that lights up with a big blood volume. You're going to want to make sure if you can't take the whole tumor out, you need to get the most malignant part in a biopsy. So you direct the biopsy there. or you know what it was behaving like at baseline. So after surgery and radiation, you're getting your follow-up scans. We routinely get those evening kids with a perfusion using gadolinium. And then you can say, oh, here's this part that looks a little fishy on the regular images, but it has a big blood volume. I think that's active tumor. And so it's really helpful both at diagnosis and during follow-up, especially the post-treatment brain radiation necrosis versus tumor recurrence question.
I've always thought that it was fantastic. Being a technologist, obviously, is fine. You know, it's looking at it, you know, as prognosis, treatment, just exactly what you're saying. But unfortunately, I think it's very underutilized. And Bill, I would love to hear your opinion on this as well. It's not just pediatrics, it's also adults. But what do you think, Bill?
Oh, I think perfusion, it's almost like, it's not quite as bad as spectroscopy, which one time I heard somebody say it's the application of the future and always will be. But it's just, I haven't seen, perfusion used to the extent that it should be utilized. And to our point, we said, I mean, you're giving them gadolinium anyway. All you're doing is taking images of it while it goes through the brain. So you're really not, taking any substantial extra time, if any. One of the things that somebody brought up one time in a conference I was doing, and I think it was a radiologist, and they said, well, can you get paid for doing that? And maybe he didn't like my response, but my response was, you get paid for answering the clinical question. And, you know, it's going back to something that Howard said, rather than having some big blanket protocol, and this can be problematic with peds, that's got a bazillion series in it so that you capture everything, so we won't miss anything, so we're going to do everything. And in fact, I was talking with a client the other day. They wanted my input on their brain protocol, which was excessive, non-contrast brain. I said, why are you doing, two of these things? Why don't you just do one 3D data set? You know, and we kind of go, well, Dr. Smith likes this and Dr. Jones likes this. And if we don't do one or the other, then they'll both be mad. And at the end of the conversation, they wound up keeping it the way it is because they didn't want to change anything. Everything's stagnant. And I think that's the same way with not using perfusion. That's a long way around it, but I feel very strongly about it. It's an excellent technique and, should be implemented because it gives you additional information.
You know, I think one thing that's going to really move it forward is in the stroke area where late arriving patients, beyond 6 hours or so, who might have a large vessel occlusion, we now have randomized clinical trial data showing that advanced imaging, including and especially perfusion, can help identify patients who are still good candidates for thrombectomy. So a lot of practices will be doing this with CT. They'll get accustomed to, thinking through the different metrics and what they mean physiologically. And I think that'll facilitate, perfusion adoption in other areas as well. And the same, in many cases, most cases, the same perfusion software package can work both with CT and MRI. And so that's going to really, I think, move things forward. And, a lot of the non-adoption is just fear or not feeling uncomfortable with something that, folks didn't learn in residency or fellowship. But once you do it on a routine basis, it becomes really helpful, sometimes in unexpected ways.
I have one more question about perfusion. Do you both qualitative and quantitative, do the quantitative, RCBV, those different things, or do you just qualitative, just look at the images?
Well, we at Wisconsin, we have two approaches to perfusion. One is we use a commercial software package that was designed for stroke, but is still useful for tumors. It's called Rapid. There are others that are out there that do similar work. That particular package was the one used in the randomized clinical trials for stroke, which is one reason we use that. But for tumors, we actually still use a 20-year-old program that is, our own in-house software that deconvolves the data set. So it's quantitative. It makes color maps in about a minute, sends them back to PACS. And we get estimates of permeability as well as CBV on that one. To be honest, you know, it's usually a qualitative thing, but with stroke imaging, you use the quantitative features where you have specific thresholds that indicate, for example, likely core infarct versus areas that are poorly perfused and will go on to infarction if you don't do something. So it's a little of both, Kristen. And, you know, the visual analysis is still really, really useful, especially in the ischemia stroke world.
Before we come to the end of this particular podcast segment, I want to talk about labeled indications for pediatric patients. And it's interesting, you guys were telling me before we were, you know, got started here and having some discussions, there's actually way more gadolinium contrast agents now with labeled indications for not only pediatric patients, but younger. Could y'all tell us about those?
Sure. Just in the last few years, several of the agents have gone forward with more data to the FDA and gotten indications for full-term neonates up to 2 years old. There were previously several that were 2 years to adult. But at the present time, I think there's, neonatal on upward approval for Doterim and Clariscan, Gadivist, Multihance, and Prohance. And Clariscan and Prohance, I think, are just very recently approved, but they've been used for, you know, decades. Among those, Multihance has the unique approval to be used at either half or three quarter dose or full dose in the neonates, which, combined with its highest relaxivity, may be an advantage in certain situations.
Because aren't there some situations where you might want to literally give a lower dose and then, you know, have that flexibility is kind of handy?
Absolutely. You may want to split a dose to do, say, a perfusion and a Trix or something in the same protocol, or you may just want a lower gadolinium exposure over the life of the child who may be getting repeated doses. Multihance is the only linear agent that's on that list of neonatal approvals. The others that I mentioned are all macrocyclics, and that has some influence on likelihood for gadolinium retention, even though that's never been shown to cause any clinical problems.
So I'm looking at, I just have a question for Howard or you, Bill. So looking at these different agents, if you have a brain and with and without, and then a total spine, you know, for drop mets, looking at a brain tumor follow-up, looking at Multihance versus the other agents, Multihance being linear and the rest of the others that you've mentioned being macrocyclic, do you ever find a situation where you give a certain amount of gadolinium and then you give it later because it's elapsed, you know, possibly more than an hour? And, you know, which agents would you recommend for that?
Well, Multihance is the one that's been shown in multiple double-blind crossover studies to show better performance for brain tumor enhancement characteristics, things like lesion border and definition, et cetera. And that's due to its higher relaxivity than any of the others, including Gadivist, which is a bit higher relaxivity than all the others we mentioned. So we like to give a full dose of Multihance for brain tumors, even in kids when we're doing a brain and spine. And our approach has been to try to make that brain a more efficient exam, and shorter, and we often do the spine all post-GAD for drop mets, for example. And so that's made the imaging times quite a bit shorter. If we have a new tumor or a recently post-op tumor, sometimes we need to do a pre- and post-contrast spine, and we feel comfortable topping them off with another half dose if it's been, say, 30, 40 minutes by the time you get down to the spine.
Do you think that's a important consideration? Say maybe someone doesn't, wants to use, you know, purely macrocyclic, you know, across the board. With these exams that are going, you know, so standard relaxivity, you know, which again is everything other than Multihance. So with those agents, the use of those agents, when you've had the patient on the table for 45 minutes already, and, you know, you're looking for small lesions down the spine, That's always concerned me that that's, you know, for a standard agent, that's a little bit long to be hoping you still see something.
That's right. It's sort of like the analogy to the MRA, where you get sort of a longer tail on your contrast enhanced MRA with the highest relactivity agent, multi-enhancer gadobenate, than you do with the other ones. And I think by extrapolation, it makes sense, although I don't think anybody's ever, you know, studied it in detail. It'd be hard to do, that you probably have some more latitude and a little bit longer window to image the spine with multi-hands.
But if you're using
on the other hand,
but I was going to say, but if you're using a standard relaxivity agent, considering topping them off with an additional dose would probably not be a bad idea.
I totally agree. And a lot of pediatric sites have chosen to go all macrocyclic. So we now, you know, at least we have Prohance in addition to Dotarym, Clariscan, and Gadivist are all macrocyclics and could be used certainly and are approved for enhancing CNS lesions and spine lesions. So those cases, I'd probably want to top them off if you've got a more lengthy a brain protocol and you've waited 30, 40 minutes. I would worry about missing things in the spine with a standard agent.
One of the other things I'd like to mention, and I've heard Kristen speak to this before. I personally have no experience with it, so I'm going to let you guys discuss it. When you're using, if you're using Gadivist for children, especially smaller children, depending on what you're doing, because it's one molar, the volume that you deliver would be half of what you would be delivering using a half molar concentration. Just as a, for the sake of argument, if a child would normally get, say, 6 mLs of a standard or half molar agent, then if you're using a one molar agent, same dose would be 3 mLs. If you gave the child 6, you'd be double dosing them. But so 3, but that's a very low volume, and that can be problematic in certain clinical techniques. Would you all not agree?
I know that we run into situations where you've got a 6 kilo baby, and then try pulling up a dose of Gadivist at one molar concentration, and you've got 3 people checking it because it's such a small amount. So, you know, I know, Howard, you said you don't use Gadivist at all, but do you have any opinions on that?
I mean, I've heard people just, you know, adding some saline to it to beef up the volume.
And that's what we do, but I think our concern is that we're still drawing up too much because it's such a small amount. And then I know there's these very complicated, and there, Dr. Interline was explaining this to me at a meeting, and the math was so complicated on how much to dilute it in that he lost me at the first equation. So, Howard, do you have any, you know, opinions on that?
Well, we even using multi-hands in a neonate or a preemie, for example, we would sometimes also dilute up if we're doing, say, a vein-a-gallon baby or something like that, where we want a time-resolved MRA. You're right. You're talking about fractions of an ml. We'll pull that in a, you know, a very small tuberculin-like syringe, so we know what we're getting, and dilute that up to a total of some reasonable injectable volume, like 2 or 3 mLs. And inject it that way. And, you know, it's all off-label and it's all according to your protocol and your specific needs. For example, a time-resolved acquisition that has to hit the center case base at the right time and so forth. I personally don't have a problem diluting contrast when necessary. I know that sometimes in cardiac imaging, we'll also dilute the contrast a little bit so we can tell endocardium from the blood pool. So I think as long as you have a good rationale, like so many other off-label things, it's reasonable to go forward with that.
Speaking of off-label, as our last topic here, Howard, I'd like you to give us and the listeners a really good explanation, put you on the spot, of off-label use, because I think that's often misunderstood. Like, well, it's not approved for it. Well, approval's not really a good word. It's a label indication is what it has or doesn't have. Would you mind speaking to that before we end this segment?
I think that's a real important point, Bill. There's a lot of misunderstanding. What the FDA does and does a really good job at is they review the application from the pharmaceutical company for, say, a contrast agent that we're talking about. They look at the data, make sure that the risk benefit is there, and the indications that are being applied for. Now, just like so many other areas in medicine, you know, it's a pretty steep and expensive road to get to that FDA approval process. And the companies may not want to spend, you know, another $500 million to get their antibiotic or their contrast agent approved for, say, another indication. Most of these contrast indications we've talked about are CNS. But we use gadolinium throughout the body. That's off-label. But it turns out that off-label, if it's supported by scientific literature, experience, and seems to be the best thing for the patient based on the physician's recommendation, clinical practice guides how you use an approved agent or antibiotic. The FDA doesn't approve indication. It doesn't approve the indications. They approve the label that states the indications, and there's nothing illegal or immoral or against IRB rules or anything else to use a medication or a contrast agent in an unlabeled fashion. So, in fact, in many times, the off-label use is actually the best choice for the patient. And so you have to go for the patient. And, you know, as long as you have good rationale, you're not only in good shape, you're doing the right thing.
Well, in fact, an off-label application or use, particularly of a gadolinium contrast agent, would be seen from a legal standpoint as a standard of care. And so to not do the care, you know, using the excuse, well, it's off-label, is not a valid excuse.
That's right. It's almost just the opposite. Our legal team has told us, if you're not considering off-label uses, you're not practicing medicine at the standard of care.
Well, that kind of brings us to the end of this particular segment. As I said earlier, this is a two-part series, two-part segment podcast on neuroimaging. We've addressed peds in this component of it. And in part two, we're going to focus more on the adult population, although I'm sure we'll drift back to peds as we tend to want to do. So we hope you have enjoyed part one of this particular podcast topic. Kristen, Howard, I want to thank you for taking the time to join me. I appreciate your input.
Thank you, Bill. Good on you, man.
Thank you, Bill.
All right, guys. Again, this particular podcast has been made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics. We appreciate their support. So look for part two, and we're done. So you'll just have to get over it. We'll talk to you on the next MRI cast.
Bye.
Bye.